Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live, 101.3 KPCG, online at kpcg.fm. Coming up on today's program, there's some turmoil in South Korea. We've got some details about that. Also, for the people that really like archaeology, they found a 3,000-year-old statue of an Egyptian pharaoh, and it's gigantic, as you'd expect. A very surprising number one bestseller on Amazon. It's a very quick read. We'll have details. And encouraging teens to work on some tough jobs. It's good for them. That and more on this edition of Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on this weekend edition on 101.3 KPCG. We're online, kpcg.fm. We have a live link at thetrumpet.com, too, a sort of a revised trumpet.com if you checked it out lately. And you can also follow us on Twitter at kpcgfm. If you'd like to email us, please do that. Comments at kpcg.fm. Our inbox isn't full. We've got room. There's space. I'm Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondo here today as well. And so we had a very nice concert here last day or so at the Armstrong Auditorium of the Ukraine Symphony Orchestra, right?
National Symphony Orchestra of Ukraine.
It was a long title, and I knew the words, but just not in the right order. So hopefully a lot of listeners got to come out and enjoy that concert. That was quite nice. One of the longest standing ovations I think I've ever seen. So congratulations.
End of both halves of the show, too.
Yeah.
Not just the end.
Yeah, just the stamina that it takes to keep applauding. It takes a lot of effort. A lot of audience participation there.
Good calories that way, actually.
Yeah, but they were tremendous, and so that was really an enjoyable concert. Of course, you can look at armstrongauditorium.org to see the upcoming concerts. There will be more throughout the season. Some headlines to get to today. Court unanimously ousts South Korea's leader for corruption. South Korea's constitutional court removed impeached President Park Geun-hye from office in unanimous ruling Friday over a corruption scandal that has plunged the country into political turmoil, and it worsened an already serious national divide. And it was a stunning fall for the country's first female leader. So some problems are in South Korea. Now they're having some protests about it. I think two people so far have been killed in those. So North Korea is as volatile as they are. They do have one leader for a while, but South Korea is having some problems with this.
Yeah, it's and it's right on the heels of North Korea continuing their war against the Pacific Ocean, because the U.S. and South Korea were doing their annual military maneuvers last week, and so in defiance, North Korea fired four ballistic missiles into the ocean. Which I mean, it's comical in one sense of the word, but also they're just trying to show that they don't like that and that. There is heightened tension there, and with her falling, the South Korea is pretty weak right now politically, and I wonder if the North will try to capitalize on that.
Yeah, it's interesting to see those things occur. So some instability in that region over there, and of course, probably be more updates on that on the Trumpet Hour Week in Review program. Don't know exactly what will all be talked about, but I think that they do talk about South Korea quite a bit, so there'll probably be a lot more information there and at thetrumpet.com as well. For those that really enjoy archaeology and finding things, this is a pretty neat story. It's from CNN.com. Colossal 3,000-year-old statue unearthed from Cairo Pit. Digging in Egypt, you're going to find all kinds of neat things. There's so many movies that are kind of about that, right? Archaeology and finding things in the pyramids and things like that. But they keep finding stuff over there. A team of archaeologists has discovered a giant 3,000-year-old statue thought to depict Ramses II. In what the Egyptian Ministry of Antiquities is describing as one of its most important archaeological discoveries. It's a giant thing. They've got a picture there at CNN. It's a huge statue. You know, if you're a pharaoh, you're not going to have a little statue. Right? You're going to want a big statue.
Or maybe just a big one and a bunch of little ones as well. But you have to at least have the big one, too.
Got to have the big one to strike fear into people. Archaeologists from Egypt and Germany began removing the quartzite statue estimated to stand 26 feet tall, just a little taller than Shaquille O'Neal, from the ground in the greater Cairo area in front of state representatives and media crews Thursday. And they say he lived to be 96 years old, had over 200 wives and concubines, 96 sons, and 60 daughters. So they didn't find statues of any of those people, but they found one of him. So that's a long life and a lot of offspring. So long was his reign, they say, that all of his subjects when he died had been born knowing him as Pharaoh, and there was widespread panic that the world would end with the death of their king. He had his name and accomplishments inscribed from one end of Egypt to the other. Virtually no ancient site in Egypt which does not make mention of Ramses the Great.
It was really interesting because I just, in class, we're going over Egypt, how they were able to carve rock so quickly is they would actually heat the rock with fire, cool it down quickly by pouring water on it, and it would create these fault lines in the granite, and then they could start digging away at it because they didn't have any power equipment back then.
Right.
Obviously, so... that's why they could shape these huge statues of solid rock, is that because they actually used science to do it with heating and then cooling quickly.
Yeah, it's fascinating how ancient civilizations were able to build some pretty impressive things, like the pyramids, Petra. I saw a neat documentary on that, how they think they built some of the things there. And so, yeah, they had to be very inventive, and they're... Obviously, what they built has stood the test of time, right? You can't find too many houses. My house won't be around in a couple thousand years, I'm pretty sure. But the pyramids last.
Yeah. I guess what stood out to me, though, was all those wives and concubines and children that he had. I can't even think about the statue anymore after you mentioned that part.
Well, yeah, that's why if you have that many wives, I guess you need a really big statue.
Yeah, I read recently like a really high percentage, like a shockingly high percentage of people from Asia have ties back to Attila the Hun, because I guess he was obviously in the whole region and he had tons of women, too, so... All of them. I think he had like thousands of children.
Yeah, there's some examples of people doing that, but interesting. So pretty neat. You can go to CNN.com, probably some other places, and look at that story. And they've got pictures of the people standing next to the statues, kind of broken apart, the giant part of the head. And then I guess some people were upset because they used like a forklift and to pull it out. And they probably wanted to be more careful, but it's a giant statue. What are you going to do?
Can't be too delicate or else it won't move.
I would think so. I mean, I guess you'd get a bunch of people there and try to pick it up or something. I don't know. But you know how it is. I know from what I've heard and seen about the archaeology and the digs we've been involved in here at Armstrong College over in Jerusalem, you have to be very, very careful because they are very small things you could easily... Well, Abraham, well, you were there working on it. I mean, you can't just go in with a jackhammer and a, you know, whatever. But in this case, they had to use big equipment.
Well, the times I did, I did end up breaking some pottery. So.
You used to be on the dig.
Yeah.
Until the jackhammer incident. Kidding. There was nothing like that that I know of. Here's an interesting story. Soda loses its U.S. crown. Americans are now drinking more bottled water. Surprise anybody?
No. Well, I think sometimes it's just from living in this area, the bottled water sales are not because of lack of soda. It's because of the terrible tap water in the area as well.
That's part of it. Yeah, it's two things. It's concerns about health effects of sugary drinks and then the safety of public water supplies. Well, there's such an obesity epidemic in the country, a lot of it linked to sugary drinks, soda in particular, and it's like a lot of things. The more research comes out, the more you find out that there are problems with it, the more people say, you know, I don't know that I want to do that.
And they have that sugar tax now that is, I mean, I guess that's causing a lot of layoffs, and obviously it makes the price of the drinks skyrocket too, so maybe that could be part of it.
They're going to have to, I guess, figure out a way, those soda companies, to try to re-brand themselves or something, because it's easy enough to drink them. But once you start realizing what's in them, you look at that glass and you think, I don't know if I want to put that in me.
They might want to inject a little bit of honesty into the commercials, like just give a caveat that you shouldn't be drinking it all the time. Because at least that way, if they came across as somewhat trustworthy, then maybe people would trust them a little bit more.
It'll be like those commercials for medications, where it'll be this really happy time and a family having a good time and all drinking soda, and at the bottom it's got all the text. And a really pleasant sounding voice saying, this may lead to obesity, diabetes, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, that, you know, the tagline when I was growing up, I think it was for Pepsi, they kind of rebranded themselves as like the choice of the next new generation or something like that. And, well, the next generation is decided not to drink it anymore. So maybe it's still the taste of the old generation.
Well, I did see in the store Coke. I'm not sure if they're doing this anymore, but they had this new brand of like green Coke. It's Coke Ball comes in the green.
Oh yeah,
green packaging, and it's supposed to be sugar free or some kind of healthy version of Coke. And it, but I always see it full on the shelves because I don't think people buy.
Yeah. Maybe that's not the best color. Scare people away.
Yeah.
Drink our green elixir. Yeah, I know that it's just the bottle that's green, but still. Yeah. It's, interesting. So they're losing some of their money on that. I suppose probably the biggest place where they would still sell in general would be restaurants, because that's kind of the main thing they offer you at a restaurant, unless you're going to buy an alcoholic beverage, which are extremely expensive, or... do you want to drink the water? That's kind of one of those where it's a little dicey. It reminds me of going through the airport in St. Louis years ago, and I was very thirsty, so I stopped and got a bottle of water, and they charge you crazy price, you know, airport. So I drank it, and I looked, after I was done drinking, I looked at the label, and it said St. Louis tap water. They just, like, filled it up out of the tap, and they gave it to me. I thought this was, like, purified from the Alps. It was just from the St. Louis water system.
That just shows you shouldn't have too high of expectations. You're always going to be let down.
$4 for that. I expected, pure springs. I didn't get it. We've been talking a little bit over the last couple months, I guess, on and off about, some problems with some of the retail stores and malls and things. And this is from Yahoo Business. It says, retail CEO says the wave of stores closing may even accelerate, talking about malls in particular. Urban Outfitters CEO Richard Haney does not have comforting words for the retail industry. He says, our industry, not unlike the housing industry, saw too much square footage capacity added in the 1990s and early 2000s. He said it was like a bubble, and the bubble is bursting, and so they're going to see more doors shuttering and rents retreating. They built a lot of space, a lot of malls. The rents got expensive. They filled up, and they say the bubbles burst there, and so now they're going to start closing down. So it's going to be a ghost town, ghost malls of America.
Yeah. I mean, I still like going to malls once in a while. But I think a lot of people, they don't end up buying too much when they go to a mall anymore. It's mainly for the social aspect of it. They go see a movie because the theaters are there usually or whatever it might be. And it's a lot of young people.
Yeah.
And they don't have a whole lot of disposable income compared to adults.
Yeah, typically teenagers, and which has probably kind of been the way it's been. And then sometimes you see older people just taking a walk for exercise. You can tell that that's what they're doing, taking their daily jaunt around the mall. But a lot of the stores, the quality is so-so. So as an adult, when you become and you have the refined tastes that we do, I don't know that you're going to Urban Outfitters as much. It's more of a teenage spot. So not a lot of those stores appeal to me as an older person.
Yeah, and a big problem with malls, too, is they don't really provide any necessities. So obviously, you can go there for a lot of things that you might enjoy or dabble in once in a while, but if you don't have some sort of staple like we were talking about, like putting a grocery store in there, that would be pretty smart, because then you could go to get the things you need, but also check out the things that you don't really need, and that would make you more likely to buy, because you're actually in the building at least.
Right, yeah, and they say, you know, one of the things obviously that's hurting sales is the direct-to-consumer channel is growing faster, the internet. You just go to their website and buy it, and it shows up at your door. A lot of times it's free shipping, or the shipping doesn't cost too much. So easier to do it that way. It's interesting, some of these companies that own, you don't realize what they all own, but I guess Urban Outfitters, part of that company, they also own Free People, Anthropology, and other stores like that. So
wow.
You see all those stores in the mall, and you're like, but they're all owned by the same. And it's the same flavor of stuff. It's kind of that young teenage, what do they call it? I forget, there was a title for it. Fast fashion, I think.
Oh.
To wow. Where it doesn't cost a lot. You don't expect to be, it's not like you're going to be keeping it for more than a month or two, and then you move on with life.
The clothes slowly dissolve until it just becomes dust.
That's right.
After an expiration date there. Wow.
Yeah, check the expiration date on the clothing. But, it is interesting how that works. I mean, sometimes, I've had, I guess, a dress shirt or something from a place like that, and it's lasted as long as a better one that I got. Right. So I'm like, what's the difference? Why did I don't know. They're all made by the same people, I guess. I don't know about that. But here's a really neat story. This is kind of a local one, but I think it'd be inspiring for a lot of people. Oklahoma 5-year-old girl is the youngest contestant in National Spelling Bee history after an impressive performance. 5 years old. Think about what you were spelling at five. Like dog, apple.
Power Ranger.
I could not. Well, those didn't exist when I was five. So, could you spell Power Ranger at five?
I don't know. That's just the only thing that popped in my head.
Maybe you could. I could spell He-Man at five. H-E and then the dash M-A-N. It's pretty easy. They say with a white bow in her hair, the five-year-old correctly spelled, I can't even pronounce these words, Jana, J-N-A-N-A. Would it just be Nana? The J would be silent. I don't know. Her 37th word at the Oklahoma Green Country Regional Spelling Bee, she became the youngest person ever to qualify for the Scripps National Spelling Bee. And so at 5 years old, she's going to be in this. It's amazing. She is very bright, according to her mother. All parents say that, but in this case, it's actually true.
Yeah, you have to have some fruits to back it up. And in this case, she can just point to that pretty easily. What if she went on and won the whole thing at 5 years old?
I know.
Then you'd really have something to brag about.
Where do you go from there? That's all downhill. The parents said, we were amazed to find that she really has a knack for spelling and can remember words that she's seen or heard very easily. Edith's parents discovered her unique skill last summer as they were having dinner one night. Her mother was quizzing her on spelling and asked her to give a go at restaurant, which is a tough word to spell, a word she hadn't been taught, and she spelled it right off the bat.
Wow.
5 years old. So 5 years old, it's hard to say restaurant.
Yeah, well, they're just in kindergarten, usually learning the very basics, and she can spell better than probably most high schoolers or university kids, unfortunately.
It's true. She might just be sort of a savant in that way. Edith, who is homeschooled, is preparing to compete in the final level of the prestigious Spelling Bee competition, which will be held near Washington, D.C. between May 30th and June the 1st. And I think that they usually put that in like ESPN. It's considered a sport.
Yeah.
So, there is a little bit of high drama in there, especially a little girl like this. Everyone's going to be rooting for her, I would think. 5-year-old girl, that'd be amazing. They asked her what she's going to be doing to prepare between now and then. She said, I like play outside or play piano, maybe study animals. So that's what she's going to be doing. Sounds like a pretty good day.
Sounds like she's pretty mentally free. She's not too stressed out, which could give her a pretty good chance. That's a huge part of sports is just the mental aspect. So maybe that's why they include it on ESPN too.
Yeah, it could be. Well, you know, people would just be, you know, if she does well, I think she'll really get a lot of national attention and people will be excited about it, and you know, the judges will be inadvertently mouthing the words to her, the letters, not even realizing it.
It'll be rigged just for the story, just for the ratings.
That's amazing, yeah. But imagine the pressure. Say you're older, and this kid's outspelling you. You're like, oh, come on now.
Yeah, I remember watching. I actually watched a couple of spelling bees, not the whole thing, but just flipping the channels. You see, oh, why is this on a sports channel? But sometimes, like the kids, they try to make jokes or something while they're up there and they fall flat. Or sometimes they are funny or they try to do these weird dramatic outbursts and like they fist pump in victory. Sometimes a kid gets a letter wrong and it's just really funny.
Yeah.
Some of them are just so socially awkward because they've done nothing but learn words their entire lives. And so like even before they have to spell the word, they're like, yes, I know this one. Like, okay, don't get too high on your horse right now. We got to make sure you spell it right first.
Right. Yeah. Or you have that like thing that you see sometimes on a Wheel of Fortune where it's an obvious puzzle and they say the wrong word.
Yeah.
You're like, you were missing one letter and you'd missed it. It could happen. This is pretty interesting. I was telling you guys about this before we came on. Number one Amazon bestseller for books. We talked about literature yesterday and the importance of it. 266 blank pages on why to vote Democrat. This is no joke. And I don't bring it up to be political in any way. I just thought it was a funny story. It says, looking for a quick vacation read? It doesn't get any quicker than Michael J. Knowles' book titled Reasons to Vote for Democrats. All of the pages are blank. He's a Yale graduate and correspondent for the Daily Wire, a conservative website. He self-published the book, which contains only headers and a bibliography, along with 266 empty pages. The book, a clear attempt to troll Democrats, has set the internet on fire and vaulted to number one bestseller spot on Amazon.
Wow.
He's a number one selling author. 266 blank pages.
It's amazing he's allowed to even have his title on the book. He didn't even write anything for it.
Yeah, it's one of those things where I guess, I don't know, you probably go into it thinking like, oh, this will just be funny or whatever. And all of a sudden, I mean, he's, I don't know what they sell it for, but I mean, he's making money. I could see people buying it, putting it like on their coffee table and be like, hey, check this out, you know, because it would be kind of a funny thing or an infuriating thing, depending on which side you're on. Now, is the other side going to do it now? You can't, because it's already been done. You can't, like,
you can't
try
just
to
play copycat the whole time. So I guess it says there's subheads in there. There's a bibliography, like all the sources he's looked at and apparently found no reasons to vote Democrat from all those sources that he looked up.
Self-published it with headers and a bibliography and then 266 empty pages. Well done.
That's amazing.
Well, I need to get self-publishing here pretty soon myself.
he's up there now with the Pet Rock guy. The guy that made money selling the Pet Rocks.
Yeah.
It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing.
And everyone knows it's nothing, and they still buy it.
They still want it. They still want the you know, I could see people like buying it for their relatives or something, like setting it to them. Hey, I got you something. You know, if you've got to have a little bit of a squabble or something, you're trying to troll your relative. I don't know. I mean, but hey, the guy's making some money. That's a very bizarre thing to have happen. So anyway, if I don't know. It's, a lot of people are buying it.
I should write one called Why to Cheer for the Toronto Maple Leafs and have 10 blank pages or something like that.
This is an endless opportunity here.
It's such a good idea.
Yeah.
It's amazing people haven't thought of something like that.
Yeah, it's really really interesting. I guess it's one of those things where it's, you know, you could wonder, is it a good idea or whatever, but if you're the first one to come up with it, well, it is what it is. It's like the artist that painted the canvas black, and it was a famous painting. It is a famous painting. It's like, well, anybody could do that. And they say, yes, but he did it.
I've actually seen portraits or pictures at the art museum where it's just a pencil and there's a straight line of granite across the page or lead across the page, and that's it. And yet it's like worth $1 million.
Sure. It's all about, I guess, perspective. Of course, this one happened. This is from saintaugustine.com. This guy was... Well, he was working at Walmart, and he went out to collect the carts, and he found a 5-foot dead shark in the parking lot. And it's not, and so he put it in the shop, just laying there, and he put it in the cart, and he brought it in. St. John's County Sheriff's deputy responded to a strange call Friday afternoon when the assistant manager at Walmart on US 1 called authorities, saying that she had found this 5-foot dead shark in the store's parking lot. The shark was laying near an RV. Maybe he drove the RV there. We're not sure. We don't know.
Then keeled over.
He only could be out of the water for so long. The deputy called the owner of the RV, who said he was from West Virginia and in the area looking for work. He told the deputy he heard noise outside his RV early that morning, but assumed it was employees gathering carts. When he left the RV to go to work later in the morning, the man said he saw the shark on the hood of his RV.
What?
So he put it on the ground. And so they don't know what to do about it. But so this guy's living in an RV. He gets out of there and he sees a 5-foot dead shark on his hood there.
Another prank, just like that empty book.
Maybe. Where did it come from? There's a picture of it, and it's in pretty good condition. I mean, the shark is. And it's just in the shopping cart.
I know how this happened.
Okay.
It was a Sharknado. It had to be.
You know what? That's one of the first comments on the story when you read it. Everyone jumped on board. Just
fell from the sky.
Another funny comment. Somebody said, I'd hate to see the bird that dropped that.
it's morning worm for the baby kids.
Yeah. So what a strange thing to occur. You know, they talk about the strange things that occur at Walmart. There probably are quite a few, but this has got to be one of the weirdest.
Yeah. Well, I just imagine the guy might have iron nerves, but in an RV, you wake up and you're going through the little space there, and then you look at the windshield and there's a gaping shark mouth, like at your windshield. Like, what would you think?
He just put it on the ground. That's all he did.
Yeah, that seems a little, I don't mean this as a pun, but it seems fishy to me because. I would probably call the authorities. I'm not sure what's going on, but somebody put a shark on my, you know.
Yeah.
I wouldn't just put it on the ground.
It's probably a normal Wednesday for him, just living in an RV.
Yeah.
You know, and you're in a parking lot, a lot of weird things happen, so he's probably just used to it.
Maybe he didn't want to draw attention to himself. Maybe he shouldn't be there. Yeah, who knows? But anyway, all kinds of weird things happening.
Maybe he should have done mouth to mouth resuscitation. At least tried.
So. See if he could bring him back.
Did you see that headline about the dead giraffe found in a parking lot too?
Yeah.
And then there was that decapitated bird in Germany we talked about too, or the penguin. Yeah.
Penguin.
And the poachers in France broke into a zoo and killed a rhino.
Right.
A few days ago, I think.
Yeah. It's like animal attack, animal wars. So strange. Yeah.
Almost all of them in the parking lot, too.
Yeah. You never know what you're going to run into in a parking lot of a Walmart or other places. This is Trumpet Radio Live here at 101.3 KPCG, and we're online at kpcg.fm with a live link at thetrumpet.com. And you can follow us on Twitter if you'd like at kpcgfm, or email us comments@kpcg.fm. New Key of David program today, also Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury. From Edstone, England, check that out. Also, thetrumpet.com. It's new and revamped. You guys have seen it, I assume?
Yeah, I checked it out this morning. Stephen Fleury tweeted about it, and I followed his link there. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's it looks pretty neat.
Yeah, it's nice to get a refresh.
I looked at it early this morning on my phone, but I didn't notice. So maybe
they didn't push it yet.
Maybe I was a little too early.
Yeah, you were an early bird. But some great analysis pieces today. Russia and China dangerously ahead of America in cyber attack ability. That's by Jeremiah Jacques. Some related stories to that. What happens when the plug gets pulled and America's Achilles heel and Germany. Those stories are some of the top ones at thetrumpet.com, but it's a new look. Same great content, new look. Check it out. Trumpet.com.
That's what I say to my wife every morning when I put on my clothes.
Same great content, new look.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. That's a good thing to do. Grant, you've got a really interesting write-up for us here. This is from LifeSet. The title is "A Little Struggle Never Hurt Anyone." Today's coddled teens need to find, get, and hold jobs that teach them valuable skills for life. This reminds me of a book I've been reading by Tony Dungy, who is a famous NFL coach and player over the years. Now he's an analyst. And when he was a freshman in college, he had to work at a meatpacking plant. And he said he hated it, and it taught him he never wanted to work at a meatpacking plant, but it was a valuable lesson. And the dogs would always follow him home. It took him a while to figure out why. You smell like meat, Tony. That's why. So he went on to bigger and better things, but it did teach him some valuable lessons.
Right. And if he hadn't worked at that meat packing plant when he was younger, he might have done that as an adult instead of becoming rich as a coach like that. So a lot of the time, that's one thing, I guess, that it would teach you. If you're working young, you learn what jobs you want or what jobs you don't want. It gives you kind of an idea of what career path you want to take.
And that's an example in Tony Dungy's case, where he was a freshman at the University of Minnesota, and he was a star athlete. He was playing football and basketball at the time, but they would always give them jobs. And so they were doing school, they were doing the sports, and they were working and in a meatpacking plant, of all places. So I think they were back there, that would have been the 70s. I think they were trying to teach him a little bit more about just the real world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this article as well has talked about that, just real world experience. This lady who wrote this received a letter from a girl in her early 20s asking her how to find work. But then the woman who received the letter realized she wasn't just asking how to find work. She was asking the lady how to actually work. She had no idea how to do it, and she was already in her 20s. She was able to have her mother do her laundry. Her mother gave her a car and money and all the clothes she wanted, and then insisted that her daughter do meaningful activities during her summers rather than have menial jobs. So she never had to, you know, save up money to buy a car. She had one given to her. And then here she is in her 20s already, about to try and support herself, and she couldn't do it.
Yeah, it puts them at kind of a disadvantage in a lot of ways. One of them, too, is that they're used to a pretty good lifestyle, but then when you have to provide that lifestyle for yourself, it's not as easy to do, especially right off the bat. You know, it takes a while to build up what your parents had in most cases. And so they're kind of in this weird spot where maybe they haven't worked much, but they're still kind of wanting that lifestyle. And how to get there, that's the question that they don't seem to have the answer to.
And that does seem to be a big trait of the millennial generation, is wanting what the parents want, but wanting it in a matter of a few months maybe, instead of 40 or 50 years like it took our parents to achieve what they did. And this article even talks about how it's important for parents to find ways for their children to do boring work, menial jobs like that mother was trying to get her daughter to avoid, because every single job, whether you get your dream job or not, it has a good amount of tedious work. You're not going to have just absolute excitement at all times in every aspect of your job.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I can understand the point of thinking, okay, well, I don't want them to just waste them their time in a, as they would say, at a menial job. However, the other side of it is you learn a lot from that. You learn some discipline. You learn the value of showing up on time. Isn't that one of the biggest problems in society today, getting people to show up on time or to follow through with a commitment? You said you would be here at this time. Will you come? That's a mystery. You never know. I mean, places that I have worked over the years, in some cases, I couldn't leave until the next guy came on to do what I was doing. Yeah, you never knew. 10 minutes, 15 minutes, 30? Is he coming? Where is he? You know, oh, sorry. That's a real irritation. So if you can find somebody that's learned to show up on time, number one, you've learned an extremely valuable life lesson.
Yeah, I've heard that 80% of success is just showing up when you're supposed to show up, and then you can go from there. But if you don't even show up, you've already failed. So obviously you want to show up on time. That's almost an epidemic in a lot of jobs, especially when they require hard work, manual labor. People, I guess, are just reluctant to show up for their entire shift. Even jobs that require specific skills, like in construction, there's such a high rate of turnover because the guys don't want to show up every day and work hard every day like they were contracted to do.
I read it kind of it was an interesting sort of list. It was a magazine editor who's a lady, and it was like 40 things she's learned in 40 years. She just turned 40, I guess. And some of them were kind of a little dicey. But she had one interesting one about work, and maybe a little crass, but she said that the keys for success, the three things were suit up, show up, and shut up.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way she put it. And she said, talent's nice, but it's not required.
Right.
Just show up, just put your stuff on that you're supposed to wear, show up, and then don't talk incessantly about how great you are or whatever else. Just do the job. Fit in, blend in, you know?
Exactly. And there are a lot of benefits to that. You don't get fired when the round of layoffs comes around to you. You're earning money. You can actually pay for things you want instead of hoping that maybe your parents will give you an allowance, whatever the case may be. Or when you get older, you don't really have your parents to give you an allowance at all. So you have to just show up, be accountable to your boss. Those are things that you can learn at a young age. And then they actually help young people in every area. They help having patience. They help you with studying in school. You actually will persevere to find the answer to something. Even in a subject you don't like, you'll make sure you do the assignment well because you're used to doing boring work already. And I have a lot of experience with that myself. From the time I was 13, just mowing lawns or packing mail, whatever the case it was. And then pretty much whenever it came to schoolwork, I knew that I didn't really need to ask my parents for help because what were they going to do? They were going to look at the exact same textbook I already had from the class. So I just needed to sit down and work harder. My dad was always kind of meeting my complaints with a smile and a shrug and just letting me struggle through whatever the difficulty was until I found the answer myself. And then that way, when you get older, you don't have someone that you have to be dependent on for anything.
Well, it's nice, too, to work a job when you're younger that you don't love, because then you really appreciate it when you get a job that you do like. I know that's true for myself. You know, you have some menial jobs, and then when you get the one that you really like, you appreciate it more because you do remember, oh, I could be doing that other thing. And it's a good time to do it as a teen because you're a you don't need the money probably. I mean, it's nice to have. You probably do need it for some things, but you don't need to make a huge salary. You can do those jobs. But it teaches you to appreciate what you have later on as well. So there's a lot of great lessons from having a few jobs that you don't love. And even if you don't love it, what is it for? A summer?
Right.
A few months? I mean, it's not the rest of your life.
And look at the consequences when maybe kids are not taught to work whenever they're younger. They grow up and they think that a job at a fast food restaurant is like a career, and then they start demanding, you know, twice the minimum wage because they don't see that as a stepping stone. They see that as kind of like an end goal. If you've worked that job as a teenager, you say, well, that's what I did when I was younger, and I need to just keep climbing the ladder.
That's what Flippy, is that the new burger machine? Flippy. He's going to replace all the jobs.
There. Yeah, it's going to go to either extreme there. People are either going to kind of quit, or they're going to realize they need to get motivated and climb up even higher.
Yeah. So it's really some good lessons there from LifeSet. A little struggle never hurt anyone. Today's coddled teens need to find, get, and hold jobs that teach them valuable skills for life. Of course, it's a generality. It's not like everybody's in that situation, but there are a few. Actually, when I was driving home this morning, because I was exercising, that I was driving home, and I was passing some kids going to school, and it's a pretty nice neighborhood I was passing, and I just happened to notice there's about 3 or 4 of them in a row in vehicles, and it was like packed full of teenage girls, and they're driving Range Rovers and stuff. I was like, I didn't go to school like that, but
yeah.
Congratulations. I don't drive that now, let alone back then, but it is interesting, just different places. I mean, the area I grew up in, yeah, kids had cars, but they were like the old beaters, you know, that we could whatever we could get for $1,000 is what we were driving. And yeah. Then some places you see people, you know, they're driving the Range Rovers. I'm like, well, that's cool. I mean, I would have driven it if I had it too, but I don't know, you know, you don't know the situations, but it's hard to meet that same standard of living when you're doing it on your own.
Right. And obviously we're not saying that parents can't pass on wealth to their children, right. But at the same time, you know, if children are not developing a sense of responsibility and learning to earn some things themselves instead of having everything handed to them, then that's going to cause trouble later on in life. Just like that girl in her 20s we were talking about who just really did not know what working really was.
All right, because she hadn't been through that experience before. So, yeah, it is always, I think, a good thing if you can get some good jobs when you're younger. And especially if you need the bucks. I mean, if you need the money, you'll get out there.
Right.
You'll get some things done if you need to. So pretty interesting. You can read the rest of that LifeSet. A little struggle never hurt anyone. Grant, thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG. And we're online at kpcg.fm, too, with a live link at thetrumpet.com. And Abraham, what's the worst job you ever had? Better not say now.
Probably I used to work at a convenience store. Mm-hmm. And or I guess it wasn't a small convenience store, it was a pretty big store, but not all parts of the job were bad, but that was probably one of the worst jobs. And then I worked in a warehouse at night, picking orders on pallets.
Mm-hmm.
That one, it wasn't a hard job or a bad job, it was just mind-numbing, because you just drive around. It's fun to drive the machines around, but you're just driving around in circles, picking up a box and putting it on the pallet.
Yeah. Yeah, probably worst one I ever had, I guess, would be we had to do weeding in the farms up in Wisconsin, and you'd have to crawl on your knees. I mean, that's how you worked, on your knees,
right,
all day in the mud. And, yeah, it paid okay, and sometimes it was hard to get a job as a teen. You know, people don't always trust you. So, yeah, it was good hours, good money. I was glad to have it, but then when you go to another job, and you're like, oh, you mean I don't have to, like, crawl all day? You feel better about it. You feel better about life.
Yeah, exactly.
Just different perspectives there. You've got an interesting write-up here for us. This is from Quartz. As far as technology is concerned, it says, for the first time ever, scientists have edited the genetic makeup of viable human embryos. And so they're messing around more and more with this. It's like a sci-fi sort of movie come to life. A lot of different thoughts on whether they should be messing with that, but they are doing some things.
Yeah, this is probably one of the most contentious ethical issues with modern science, just whether this is something that should be done or if we should let nature and chance take its course. But in this particular development, a Chinese researcher, and they're working for, or using a technology called CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. And basically for a long time, scientists have been working at editing genetic code in embryos for a while, and they've done or used a process called or using non-viable human embryos, which means it's an embryo fertilized by 2 sperm cells, and so it will never grow into a human.
Right.
It's just non-viable. So they're not too sure how using a non-viable embryo would translate to real life. But this researchers in China, they were able to use the same kind of process on the viable embryo. So on an embryo fertilized by 1 sperm cell.
Yeah. And then, they're just seeing what happens, or they're destroying them at some point, or
Yeah, I don't know what happens to the embryos. I assume that at some point, because they're test tubes.
Yeah.
And test tubes that they're destroyed when mm-hmm. when the test is done. But basically, they're just using this molecular genetics to see if they can, once an egg is fertilized, they can go in and edit genetic code, mainly for the aim of removing genetic mutations that cause disease. So if the embryo seems to have some kind of disease, it's more probable to have some kind of disease or health problem. They can get rid of that genome.
You know, it's so crazy. I'm sure this is what everybody's thinking, but what happens then? Like, we don't know what happens. And so in trying to fix one potential problem, what are they creating? I mean, that's the fear, right? We don't know what happens.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a huge ethical complaint. I mean, I think testing on embryos isn't, most people aren't comfortable with that anyway. But with testing on viable embryos, that embryo will become a human if you let it grow. And so we don't know what will happen to that baby until we let it grow and suffer the consequences. And so, of course, a lot of people aren't too enthused about this because that could lead to a lot of just grisly scientific disasters. The scientists are pretty confident that it will work well.
Okay, yeah.
But, I mean, that's the biggest thing is the next stage in this, now that they're moving the viable embryos, the next stage is to just let the humans grow up and see what happens to them. And that could have so many unintended consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's just a result of evolution as the basis of scientific thinking, right? Because if you just think, well, you know, it's just sort of this process and there's no real intelligent thought behind it, well, we can get in there and see what happens. But if you step back and say, well, wait a second, no, I think, you know, there is a creator that made this. Do you take on that God prerogative without God knowledge? And that of course, is your dilemma. But,
yeah.
But I suppose people would come down on that thought depending on what they believe in, evolution, creation.
Yeah, and I mean, this even ties in with any kind of interference with conception or with and the development of the fetus, whether that's abortion or this kind of testing where humans, do we have the moral right to interfere in that life once mm-hmm. it's been started? And of course, the intentions are good. They're trying to prevent children from having some pretty terrible diseases. But at the same time, that's just putting a Band-Aid. What's causing unhealthy children? Sometimes it is that you can't do anything about it. Most of the time, it's a cause of generational degeneration mm-hmm. from poor living, poor health, bad decisions, that kind of thing. So
it's like, and I think even Mr. Herbert Armstrong wrote about this a fair bit, but it's trying to do away with the penalty of doing something wrong. In some cases, not that that's maybe the way they'd look at it or anything. I'm not saying that, but just for everything, you know, we might have a problem creep up in our lives and we want it to be taken care of. We don't want to have the problem anymore, but very often it's trying to treat the result instead of the cause. And so it's kind of that seems to be what people are hoping for. Like, well, I kind of want to do whatever, but not pay the penalty for it that comes. Not that people are thinking that way when they're just kind of, you know, eating whatever. Sometimes you don't realize what's happening, but still, there's a lot of dilemmas there. A lot of things to think about in terms of what does man interfere in, you know, or how do you try to solve a problem? Do you solve it at the beginning or do you solve it at the end? Try to solve it at the end.
Yeah, exactly. I think he hit the nail on the head when it comes to those kinds of issues. But if you think, let's think about it from a huge societal impact, if this actually became viable on a wide scale, this kind of idea of like racial purity, not that this has anything to do with race, but the idea that people are free from disease, they're free from, and they're like superhuman because they have certain prized traits, that those origins don't come from good things. That's
right.
Those come from, well, the Nazis were a big fan of that and other fringe groups throughout history. And so although this is well-intentioned, this is leading to the purification of basically races across the earth, where you can where you can avoid having people having problems or strengths or any weaknesses. They'll be bred like animals to have these certain strengths or characteristics. And I think if that becomes society, then it takes away from just the human experience, because part of life is having unique and overcoming. I mean, it's terrible that people are born with certain things, but as part of life.
Yeah, I was thinking about it as a parent. You know, it's exciting when you have a child and you don't know, you know, what their traits they're going to have exactly. You know, sometimes every parent will look at it and be like, oh, they kind of get that from me, or they kind of get that from their mom, or, oh, that's from my, you know, great uncle. It's right. Interesting to see how it all comes together. And then there's stuff where you're like, I don't know where that came from. But if you could get in there and manipulate it, it would be a weird sort of feeling, because you see headlines about that. I know it's way off in the future, maybe, but designer babies, you know, right. you can pick how you want it to be. And I don't know. That would just be, I don't think I'd be comfortable with, certainly, well, I wouldn't be comfortable with it at all, but just on a very physical level, I don't know. I wouldn't want to be responsible for those type of decisions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of it, is that you're choosing what the destiny of another individual will be. And that's almost like a dictatorial type of power you have over the next generation. It's kind of time and chance. And there's science behind, of course, with how a child looks and the characteristics and the personality they develop. It is scientific, but two humans who create that child don't know what the end result will be, other than it will be a child. And I think what this does is it really destroys faith. Because with people, if they believe that the child will turn out well, it destroys their faith in believing that a higher power can guide the child safely or will produce something that's healthy or that kind of thing. And I think man's taking into his hands the power to basically solve disease and solve physical disabilities, when that's not our purpose. That's outside of our realm.
Well, and it also is kind of all under the idea that people will make good decisions.
Right.
Now, what if you open that up to potential parents and said you can pick what you want? Parents pick names, right? Sometimes those are some interesting decisions that are made. I mean, whatever, people make their decisions, that's fine. But, you know, the kid's got that name, better or worse. Not everybody makes the best decisions. You know, if you could pick certain things, boy, who knows what would happen there? It's just a God prerogative that you're giving to, potentially giving to a human being, with all of our faults and lack of knowledge, lack of understanding, poor decision making. Really, really interesting topic. But we'll see. Well, they keep working on it.
Yeah, China's at the leading edge of it, but Sweden and the UK. They also have people working with this kind of genetic editing. So China is the leader. I'm not surprised, because their rules on ethics and that kind of thing are much lower level than the West. So
yeah,
they can forge ahead on this without any really criticism.
Right. Yeah. Really, really interesting stuff. We've got a little bit of time left to get one other thing to bring up today. This relates back to the Trump Daily radio show with your host, Stephen Fleury, today. He was talking about Winston Churchill and his concentration. He had very good concentration abilities. And you wanted to bring up some of Churchill's experiences from his childhood that helped form who he became as an adult.
Yeah, I think this will actually tie in with Grant's article about teenagers having mundane jobs and how it builds their character. Because, and Churchill's, I think this is a really inspiring story of the young Churchill, because given the circumstances in which he grew up and the trials he had, although he was an aristocrat and he had privilege, it's amazing he even became anything close to the man he was. He became someone who had such deep-rooted principles. That he was such a faithful husband, and that he had such strong amounts of character, because most similar trials destroy people. And when he was born, his father was Lord Randolph Churchill, and his mother was Jenny Jerome, the daughter of a wealthy American millionaire. And as at any time in the Victorian era, basically, the parents were very aloof of their children. They hardly even saw them. They just had a boarding schools, and nannies would basically raise the children. And Churchill's experience was no different. And So he grew up in a very distance from his parents. His father was very critical of him. He loves them both, but they barely visited him when he's away from at these different schools for most of his childhood and teenage years. They barely wrote back to him in his letters. And so he was starved of that attention from his parents. He basically didn't have them.
Right.
Because they were too busy having affairs or off doing their social events. And so Winston basically didn't have any father figure to look up to. He did, but the image of his father was mainly imaginary. The man who he actually was wasn't the man Churchill thought he was. And so Churchill, the big motivation in his life was to please his father, was to make him proud. And despite the terrible treatment his father had towards him, not spending time with him, some of the letters he wrote to young Churchill were so scathing, they'd probably destroy a child, a normal child. But with Churchill, he developed a rebellion against authority, probably because of resentment towards his parents. He was also very lazy, lackadaisical. He had a bad habit of being late. And so in school, he was very poor in his grades because he had all these bad characteristics, mainly because his parents didn't really teach him. They didn't do anything. So, but he overcame those. And the big reason why he overcame it, I think, was to please his father. He wanted to make him proud. His father died when Churchill was only, I think, 21. So his father died without seeing the man Churchill would become. But also, Churchill realized that if he put his mind to something, he could achieve it. If he used his all his strength to and a purpose. And so most of his life was very frustrating, arguing with it in his family, like his mother's going having affairs and having like a really messy family life. He was beat up at school all the time because he was kind of impetuous. He was beaten with corporal punishment, so he'd even bleed from being beaten by the headmasters at the different schools. Had health issues. So, I mean, he didn't have a good childhood. He didn't have a lot of examples to look up to in his immediate family. But he overcame those, and I think there's a great lesson for any young person, whatever their circumstances are growing up, is that Churchill didn't feel sorry for himself, and he didn't, in the end. There were moments, of course.
Sure.
But he didn't feel sorry for himself, and he set his mind on achieving something grand, and that was the British Empire and on serving the country. He went into the cavalry and became an officer and then later into politics. And so he didn't focus on what he didn't have or on different things like that. He did focus on serving his country, making his father proud. And once he finally had that spark of ambition, once he found a purpose, then all those negative characteristics went away. He overcame them. And I think that's what young people need to do. They need to find the spark of ambition, as Herbert Armstrong talked about too, that purpose in their life that they can really get behind, and they're willing to work through terrible jobs or be abused by people to get that to that goal. And I think it's this formative years of that young Winston Churchill that built up that indomitable spirit he had later in his life when he led Britain to victory, because he wasn't conquered as a young man by his parents, by depression, by poor health, by being beaten by his classmates. He wasn't defeated then, and that helped Britain remain undefeated during the war.
Yeah, he was toughened up in his younger years. Obviously, you'd want to avoid as much of that as possible. but as far as going out and finding a job and going out and even playing sports. I mean, you test yourself. You have to be pushed. I think back to when I was growing up and playing sports in school, and especially the first few practices, you think, I can't run anymore. And then you're like, nope, you're going to keep doing it. And then at the end of practice, I remember thinking like, yeah, I thought I couldn't run anymore an hour ago. And, it makes you tougher than, you find out that you're a little stronger than you thought you were. To a point, obviously, there's a point there where you don't want to go too far with it. But sports, learning instruments, working jobs, all these things that really do take discipline, effort, and have a goal at the end. I mean, those are very valuable, and it's great to do it when you're young because it sets the course for the rest of your life, and you have the greatest amount of time at that point and capacity for learning too.
Yeah, and Churchill wasn't shielded from negative experiences. I mean, he was much more privileged than any of us are because he did come from aristocrat, but that did come from with other pressures from society. But I think what big thing I just took away from reading about his early life lately has been all those negative experiences. His parents didn't pull him away from those unless they became, there were some breaking points they did have to, but they were encouraging him to overcome them. Although they didn't, they could have been much more involved in his life. They expected him to overcome anything with a certain zeal and spirit to overcome any obstacles in his path. And I think with young people, like whether it's working a boring job or whatever it might be, that's a good lesson that when, if you're young, if you learn to overcome obstacles, learn how to take criticism and actually take it and improve your character on it. That can really help you a lot as an adult.
Yeah, it prepared him to help save the Western world from the Nazis.
Yeah.
So pretty fascinating history there. And, of course, there's more about that in the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Make sure you check out the newtrumpet.com. Also, listen for the Key David program, Trumpet Daily, and Trumpet Hour Week in Review coming your way. And enjoy your weekend. We'll see you back here on Monday. You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KBCG.
You're listening to Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG.